You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 21st of March 2023 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Ahead in the next 60 minutes, Emmanuel Macron survives a vote of no confidence. We'll explore what this means for the embattled French president and his ability to push through reforms. Also coming up, will Donald Trump be arrested later today? The former US president certainly thinks so. We'll have the latest on UBS's takeover of Credit Suisse as details emerge of this weekend's deal.
Last year was a record year for Greece, as far as tourism is concerned.
We'll be back at MIPIM to find out which countries are attracting new business. Plus, Finland tops the table in the annual Happy Rankings. We'll also look at the papers and we'll enjoy a design roundup too. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. So a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. The White House has called on the Chinese President Xi Jinping to urge Vladimir Putin to withdraw from Ukraine. An American man who was jailed in Saudi Arabia for criticizing the government on social media has been freed from prison after a year. And Sri Lanka has been granted a bailout package from the International Monetary Fund worth $3 billion. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, Emmanuel Macron's government has survived a no confidence vote in the country's parliament. It was triggered after Monsieur Macron's Renaissance Party used an article in the French constitution to push through an increase in the pension age. But it was a narrow victory yesterday of only 9 votes. Well, joining me now from Paris is Florence Biedermann, who's a political analyst and former news editor for Agence France-Presse and a regular voice. A very good morning to you. Welcome back to Monocle 24, Florence.
Good morning, Emma.
So just summarise for us, if you could, what happened yesterday?
Well, what happened is that the government, as you said, survived. Macron's government survived 2 confidence votes. Let's say it was expected because you need an absolute majority for this to happen. And even if Macron doesn't have this absolute majority, the moderate rightist party, Les Républicains, had decided they would not vote for this confidence. And but what happened is what surprised the observers was that the vote was very narrow. I mean, he saved his neck, if I can say, with only 9 votes, and this was not expected. So it is obvious that a large part of the Republicans voted also against the Macron government, and the fact that the margin is so narrow is really a sign that the coming years will be pretty difficult for Emmanuel Macron. He still has 4 years as a term, and obviously, I mean, it will be pretty complicated for him to govern.
But let's look at this 9 votes. You say it was a surprise. I mean, how much of a surprise was it?
It was again expected that that there would be like something like 20 votes maybe from Les Républicains that. That would join this vote. So this 19 Républicains, it was not expected because the head of the party had decided that they didn't want to join this confidence vote. If it was adopted, that would mean the government would be toppled. That would mean maybe new general elections. You know, that would be really a political crisis. So their leader had decided, no, we won't vote. And eventually, a big chunk of the party, like a third of its MPs, deciding to vote against Macron. So that's what was a surprise. Like, everybody thought, yes, there will be some, maybe 9, 10 MPs who will vote. But this big part of the party was a surprise because that means the leader doesn't have authority on his MPs. That means the party is fractured. And since it played so far an important role in parliament, like to support Emmanuel Macron, because obviously they are very close to Macron in some aspects. For example, Les Républicains were supporting, you know, the pension reforms. They even wanted to extend the age to 65 years. So in this sense, they are in contradiction with themselves, which, by the way, means a second little crisis in French politics, the crisis inside the Républicain Party.
Well,
it's not the main one right now.
I'm looking forward to asking you about that in just a moment. But just the context here all stems from last year's parliamentary elections, isn't it, where Emmanuel Macron's party failed to retain a majority. And since then, everything has been a struggle.
Everything has been a struggle. He has governed. I mean, his prime minister, Elizabeth Borne, had to use this article of the constitution that allows the government to push through laws without a vote in the National Assembly. And that's what provoked the crisis, actually, because that's what happened with the pension reform. They pushed through the vote because they were afraid not to have a majority of MPs to support the law. And this is what created the crisis. It's seen as many, at least the opponents, as a kind of denial of democracy. It is constitutional. You know, legally, Macron was absolutely right to use this article. But on such an important topic than the pension reform, at this time, where there are economic difficulties for the people, stemming also from the war in Ukraine, you know, there is this kind of sensitivity in the society, and it has really not been well accepted, not only by the MPs but also by the population. And you know, already there were a series of demonstrations. There is another one that is coming on Thursday, called by the trade unions, which means even if the law has been accepted, they still don't want to accept it. And there is this tension in society right now that is really something worrying.
It reminds me of when we were speaking in last year a great deal when Macron was re-elected, and the great message that he was trying to get across to the French people was, I am here for you and I am going to listen to you and I am with you. That seems to have not happened, does it? Because we have him ignoring widespread protests in France, and B, almost ignoring the traditional political process by forcing through a law on a technicality.
Yeah, I think he had no choice anyway if he wanted the reform to be adopted. But you're certainly right, Emma. If you remember what Macron said during his campaign for his re-election a year ago, I am different. I will listen to the people. It's very striking to see that actually he didn't do it. Okay, you can think it's because he cannot change. You can think also because of the mathematics, because of the situation, because he didn't have a strong majority. He actually didn't have much choice.
One thing that is interesting, though, is that this is an issue which French government successively have tried to grapple with. That is, you know, raising the pension age and also addressing the issue of the unions, which are incredibly empowered in France. If Emmanuel Macron succeeds in these wider plans, that will fundamentally change French society, won't it?
Well, I'm not sure it's fundamental change. What is as real is that every time a government has tried to postpone pension age, to increase it, there was strong demonstration. So now, under Jacques Chirac, this is what happened. And eventually, Chirac stopped the project. Again, with Nicolas Sarkozy, there was some demonstration, but he stayed firm. Like, it used to be, pension age used to be 60, it's 62. But now, I mean, to propose this law now, in this different context, I mean, obviously, French people are, I mean, polls say 60% of them against this reform. And yes, I mean, there is this very strong feeling in this country that you have social benefits and you don't want to lose them, whatever the price is, whatever the cost. At least this is what Macron said. There is a cost to be paid and we cannot go on and accumulate debts to preserve the system. So there are those different visions. But certainly it's in the French psyche that you got social benefits through social fights. There is a bit of this revolutionary aspect, this kind of passion for equality between the people. And we want to maintain them. So he pushed a button. This is pushing a button that is yeah, pretty sensitive in the country.
And do you think he will push even more buttons now that he has this law, now that he seems to have claimed a victory and survived a no confidence vote? Do you think he will now accelerate, or do you think that there will be a price to pay? There are calls, for example, for the sacking of the Prime Minister Elizabeth Borne.
Well, Elizabeth Borne is just, you know, in the French political system, the prime minister is not that powerful. Like, whether she stays or not won't change much. Probably he will replace her, you know. Probably he may also try to make a big reshuffle. Nobody knows at this stage, maybe not even himself. But certainly, now, practically, he may not have the possibility to push through other reforms, you know, because the parliament will be even more restive and reluctant than before, first. And second, it's not in his interest. I mean, he has already, let's say, brutalized parliament. He's not going to repeat it too much. You know, he has still another 4 years. And what you can expect is that the coming reforms won't be that socially sensitive. I mean, this was the main one. He had already passed other reforms in the social, labor laws, allowing to fire more easily employees, for example. He had pushed this reform in the previous 5 years he governed. So now, I mean, basically he did the job, and it's not that he had a list of very strong social reform he wanted to pass. This was the main one. So obviously now he will rather, let's say, mellow. It's not mellowing, but he won't have to push such radical reforms again. And as I say, in any case, maybe he's not in a position to do this in Parliament.
Finally, briefly, if you don't mind, Florence, you mentioned issues within the Républicains, the Republican Party. What does this now mean for them, this schism?
I mean, that means, their goal now is to think of the next presidential election, which is in 4 years, which is, by the way, an eternity in politics. And what they want to do, you know, is to recover from the fact that Macron succeeded in completely absorbing, like, the moderate right in his government, and they were left, you know, with less power. They used to be in government, you know, and now they have only 60 MPs. So obviously their aim is to try to recover, to unite, and to try to have a candidate, a strong candidate in the next presidential election. So, yes, obviously they will have to work on their own unity, because if they are fractured, like if they have this kind of a third of the party who is not following the other two-thirds, they will be in an even, they are already in a difficult position, but they will have no hope, like, to achieve anything in the next presidential election.
Florence Biedermann in Paris, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're with The Globalist. AM in Zurich, which is where we head now, because a little over 24 hours ago, Switzerland's biggest bank, UBS, took over the country's second biggest, Credit Suisse. So are the world's finances in any more of a stable position? Well, details have emerged of the deal, with the winners and losers becoming more clear. And joining me now from Zurich is Mark Dittley, journalist and CEO of The Market, a financial media platform and a regular voice. A very good morning to you, Mark. Good to have you with us on The Globalist.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So just looking at the Swiss media this morning, I mean, there is this forensic dissection of yesterday's announcement, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, basically the nation is in shock, and that's the job of the media now, to really, really dissect what has happened here.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the main reaction has been in Switzerland to this? Because it is, as you say, such a fundamental change to Swiss banking culture, and indeed Swiss culture.
Yes, it is indeed. I mean, Credit Suisse has a 167-year history. It is basically Switzerland. Obviously, Credit Suisse was in trouble. That was known for months, and they were working on it. But things just happened very fast last week. They suffered a bank run. They suffered a panic-driven bank run, which ended in this takeover by UBS, which was orchestrated by the Swiss regulators. And people, basic people are asking, how was it possible that it even came to this? I mean, you know, how was it possible that this was kind of the last solution that was available?
What's emerging, Mark, is that this deal is far from perfect, that there are issues that are being highlighted now.
Yeah, I mean, there were actually several parts that were quite problematic in terms of laws. One was that shareholders did not get a vote, neither the shareholders of UBS nor the shareholders of Credit Suisse. They were kind of these rights were overruled in an emergency measure by the government. Also, any antitrust thoughts were basically pushed aside. You know, in the Swiss domestic market, this new bank will be huge. And then there was this very controversial issue that some bondholders, so-called AT1, additional tier one bondholders, were wiped out. And they basically lost about 16 billion Swiss francs. As far as I'm concerned, as far as I understand, this was actually foreseen in the prospectus of these bonds. So it's not a topic of law, but it was a very, very problematic decision.
You mentioned a moment ago that this is a break in tradition, that the shareholders usually take the hit before the AT1 bondholders, don't they?
Yes, correct. That's how it usually would go. Now, but one must stress that these bonds, they were issued in the past years. I mean, these bonds, these AT1 bonds, they were a consequence of the global financial crisis of 2008. And they are so-called write-down bonds or wipe-out bonds. So they can actually be triggered to be wiped out. Or investors, and mind you, these are usually institutional investors, insurance companies, and so on, who hold these bonds. So it's not the retail investors. But I think investors were shocked that they could be wiped out by a decision of the Swiss regulator.
One thing that's being highlighted there, Mark, and you mentioned there that everything is done almost within the framework of the aftermath of the financial crash of 2008, the lessons learned from there. And some are suggesting that actually nowadays, yes, we are dealing with an awful lot of dissatisfied and unhappy people, but at least there have been quicker and decisive actions here, because when you face an emergency, delaying could be even more problematic.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, these kinds of emergencies, they kind of have to be resolved over a weekend. It was clear that they had to find a solution before financial markets would open on Monday. So, yes, to act decisively was important. The thing that is so shocking is really the question of how could it even get this far? I mean, how could we even get to a position where this was the only available solution anymore? And again, Credit Suisse, which had a long and proud history, it suffered a bank run, and within a few days it was dead.
Tell us about what the new UBS looks like. It will have what? It's like 1,500 billion, I don't know how many, 1.5 billion francs in Swiss francs in assets. Just tell us just how big UBS now is. It was already Switzerland's biggest bank.
It was already Switzerland's biggest bank. Its balance sheet before was in Swiss francs it would have been a billion, but in English it's 1,000 billion Swiss francs. So it's huge. The Credit Suisse's balance sheet was about 650 billion. So now we're talking about a 1.6 trillion Swiss franc balance sheet, which is double the size of Switzerland's GDP. It's an absolute giant for the world, but also especially for the Swiss economy. Credit Suisse had about 50,000 employees. UBS had about 74,000 employees. There will be a lot of job cuts. But if you merge the two as they are, we'd be talking about about 125,000 employees.
And when you have a bank that big, twice the size of Switzerland's GDP, what does that mean for Switzerland?
Both banks, both UBS and Credit Suisse, were too big to fail before, which basically, you know, meant that Credit Suisse could not be allowed to fail in a bankruptcy case. So it had to be. This was the entire rescue operation was about not letting Credit Suisse fail, but rather having it taken over by its main rival. Now, if we had two too big to fail banks before, obviously now we have one huge too big to fail bank. An op-ed piece in the Neue Zürcher Zeitung yesterday said, a zombie has died, but we have created a monster now.
Mark Ditley in Zurich, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come on today's programme.
If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands.
And the Finns will be clapping their hands because they are the happiest country in the world. Again, find out more a little later on The Globalist. Now, will Donald Trump feel the long arm of the law later today? The former US president warned that he fully expected to be arrested today. That's Tuesday. Well, I'm joined now by Christopher Lord, who's Monocle's US editor and correspondent in Los Angeles. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Emma.
Now, will we see handcuffs and mugshots today?
As yet, it is unclear. Trump fully expects that he is going to be arrested today on Tuesday, or that is what he has told his supporters on social media over the weekend. Now, what I can tell you for sure is that authorities in New York, where it's expected that there will be an indictment filed for Trump, and that would, of course, then potentially lead to charges, that in New York now they're putting up metal barricades all around the courts for fears that his supporters might descend on that court to protest later today. Same is happening right here where I am, believe it or not, in Los Angeles, and also in Washington, D.C. So the authorities clearly believe that there's potential for protests later today from Trump supporters. And the suggestion of that is also that there is going to be an indictment raid against him. Now, just a reminder of what that case is. It goes right back to 2016, before Donald Trump became president, when the election campaign was underway. And the allegation is that he indirectly paid hush money to an adult film star called Stormy Daniels by paying his lawyer, who then paid off Stormy Daniels to keep quiet about an affair that Trump had, thinking that would cause him damage at the ballot box. That would be, if that is the case, because the way it was filed, those reports, that would be illegal, because that would be suggesting that these were, that, you know, that he was paying legal fees to Michael Cohen, where in fact, his former lawyer, whereas in fact he was obviously paying hush money. So this is the allegation that's been floating around. Of course, one of many allegations and various court cases that are really on the boil right now, potentially in the months ahead for Donald Trump. But this one is very important because the district attorney there in Manhattan, Alvin Bragg, has made clear signs that he believes that there is some kind of case to be had here. And that wouldn't be said in the way that they did, wouldn't have made those noises if they didn't believe they had something to go at here. I think it's a very important moment. And I also think it's important because, you know, if we cast our minds back, I mean, it has that whiff of those old stories that we used to get of Donald Trump that seems to just happen all the time, where it was, you know, some kind of scandal that he was yet again potentially facing, you know, whether it was impeachment or whether it was criminal proceedings and all this sort of stuff. Yet this one, in a way, potentially has that feeling that it might really decide the outlook of things as we look towards that 2024 general election.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because as you say, Donald Trump is no stranger to inquiry and criticism and inquest and indeed impeachment. But the one thing that could get him into a court is allegations that he paid an adult actress.
Yeah, that's it. And of course, for a lot of the Republicans looking at this, despite many who have rallied around him in the last couple of days, people like Mike Pence, his former vice president, and others, senior Republicans, have come out and said, oh, well, look, why is the district attorney in Manhattan focusing on this old allegations when he's got so many problems in his own backyard with law and order in New York and so on? But there is an element here where the optics of it couldn't really be worse. You know, we have to remember that Donald Trump right now is leading in the polls of who's going to be the next Republican nominee for the 2024 general election. Right now, he has got quite a substantial lead. But I think what's happening behind the scenes, despite those rallying around him, we have to remember that the other big front runner, Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, hasn't actually officially put his hat in the ring yet. But those who are rallying around him, despite their words, I think there is generally a feeling of how is this all going to land with the voters, not the base. And everybody's saying right now here, the discourse in the papers here for Tuesday morning is, well, this might energize his base. They're going to say, look, yet again, they're trying to silence Trump, the deep state, and all these kind of things that they associate with. But that base really is becoming less and less powerful by the day. What's actually going to be more important is Republicans who want to win elections. They are going to be the ones who decide who leads the party into the next election. And they are, I think, getting increasingly fed up with the reality that, you know, Donald Trump so far has lost three elections for a start. But secondly, that these kind of things, improprieties like this, really do start to look bad when you're trying to appeal to voters who maybe voted for Joe Biden in that last general election or in the midterm said, do you know, I don't think I can hold my nose and vote Republican again this time. These are going to be the people who are going to have a very, very decided impact in 2024. And I think that's why this case and this protest, whatever we're going to see in the next 24 hours, is going to be very crucial, because it's really going to sketch for you right now how Republicans are going to feel about whether they can really be confident back in Donald Trump going into that next election.
And the fact that he announced it on social media that he was intending, that he fully intended to be, you know, to be arrested today, is that an attempt to slightly change the optics, to bring back his core protesters and make people feel like he is a man more sinned against than sinning?
We have to remember that Truth Social is really Trump's own social media network. He was set up by him, you know, in the aftermath of him being kicked off of Twitter. So when he goes on there and writes something like this, he really is preaching to the converted. And he knows that he's going to get a lot of people in outrage and fire and fury from that base. And I think right now there probably is a feeling in the Donald Trump camp where he really wants a bit of that again. He wants a bit of that energy behind him, because increasingly, you know, it is, despite that lead in the polls, which is the sort of official side of this, he is drifting away from the news narrative all the time. And the more that he spends out of the news narrative, really the less powerful he becomes. That is what stokes him. And yes, we are, of course, talking about him right now. But I do believe what is happening slowly is Americans are getting bored of hearing about Donald Trump. And I think that there's a reality here where, yes, as you say, he takes to social media, he fires up the base, he says, you know, get yourselves out, this was his words, you know, take back our country, you know, go out and protest, I'm going to be arrested and so on. What I think is going to happen in the next 24 hours is, despite all these barricades being set up and these extra measures being put in by the authorities, I think it's going to be a bit of a damp squib. I do not believe you're going to see a January 6th, 2021 reenactment where, you know, vast hordes of people descend to the streets in outrage. Those days simply are over. And I think Donald Trump is keenly aware of that. I don't think he likes it. And I do believe that we are seeing, if you will, the turn of the screw on the former president. And I think this is going to be quite a pivotal moment. And we'll probably will chart this as the moment where things got set in place for where it ended up, who was up against who in the 2024 presidential election.
Chris Lord in Los Angeles, thank you so much for joining us on the line. You're at The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. In a little while, we'll be heading to MIPIM in Cannes to find out why Greece is attracting so much attention for all the right reasons. But first, a quick look at some of the day's other news headlines. The White House has called on China's President Xi Jinping to urge Vladimir Putin to withdraw from Ukraine. The Chinese leader is currently in Moscow for talks with the Russian president. The US Security Council spokesman said seeking a ceasefire is not enough. An American man who was jailed in Saudi Arabia for criticizing the government on social media has been freed from prison. Saad Ibrahim Al-Mahdi, who also has Saudi citizenship, was arrested 2 years ago when he arrived in Riyadh to visit his family. He was sentenced last year to 16 years in prison for tweets he posted while in the US. And Sri Lanka has been granted a bailout package from the International Monetary Fund worth $3 billion. There were widespread protests last year as Sri Lankans faced the worst economic crisis in decades. It's understood the government will restructure state-owned enterprises and sell off the national airline to raise funds. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Let's turn our focus to Greece. The country's been on a soft power push to attract foreign investment and more business opportunities, something that was on full display at this year's MIPIN, the world's leading real estate trade fair, which wrapped up this weekend in Cannes. Monocle was there, and our editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck, had a chance to catch up with Marinos Giannopoulos, who's the CEO of Enterprise Greece, the official investment agency of the Greek state. Andrew started by asking Marinos why it was important for Greece to be there at MIPIN.
Real estate is one of the major contributors to the Greek GDP. So for us to try and bring and expand the Greek success story by bringing companies from Greece to MIPIM is a mission in itself, because we want to show to the world that we are a success story, but at the same time we have the companies and the means to support the continuation of that success story. Real estate, in combination specifically with hospitality, leads to tourism, which is 25% of the GDP of Greece, is where we put our most our efforts to try and keep that story of bringing more and more people every year. As you know, I don't know if you know it, last year was a record year for Greece as far as tourism is concerned. And one of the main boosts that even the Prime Minister has said itself, that we want to become the number one tourist destination. That can only be done by planning and by extending the tourist season, because there's a fine number of people that you can get in the country. So by promoting that and showcasing Greece is a big deal for us, and that's why we're here in MIPIM.
And tell me, I know that one of the projects has been a bit of a benchmark for Greece to show that you're not only delivering quantity but quality is Astypalaia, this project with Volkswagen. Could you tell us a little bit where that project's now at?
Yes, basically, I'm happy you asked me this question, because we're really proud of the Astypalaia project. It's a combined effort between the government and Volkswagen, like a private oil company, trying to showcase that what can be done when companies and the government come together by using only green energy to support the island. So there's no automotive anymore, anything that has to do with petrol or any other means. It's only purely electric. Everything is electric. All the cars that are in Astypalaia are powered with green energy. We use a sharing application for people to get the bus around, which is electric. So the whole ecosystem is basically green, and there's no more other cars or means that use petrol or anything like that. And I think for us, it's what the showcase of what proper planning, working together with companies, can achieve.
And tell me, with the learnings from this project, are they being taken now to other places in Greece? Because the extraordinary thing about Greece is you have such an island community that if it worked here, you would hope that it could work in other places as well.
Definitely, yes. We like to say that we have a project called Greco Islands, which is kind of taking that knowledge and moving to different islands so we can start building that kind of hubs, just self-sustained islands on their own. Greece is one of the European countries in the forefront of using green energy. We are in November, we are one of the first countries that actually used whatever green energy was produced, actually consumed 100% for a day, for which I think it's amazing. And using all that combined with our efforts of using any funds that come from the EU, for the Repower EU and through the recovery facility, to specifically target those kind of efforts for green investments. Because as you know, to use the RRF money, you need to have a specific green tagging of like at least 40%. So any kind of plant that uses government money needs to have that in place.
And just tell me, when you're looking for investment, I presume there's another benefit of this project, is that you're trying to perhaps change in people's minds what Greece stands for as an investment, as a place to do business, and make people realize how modern it is, what a young generation of technology people you have, that you have a capability of delivering high-tech projects. Do you use this as a piece of soft power in a way to go out and show people around the world the kinds of things that are possible for Greece?
Of course. As you can appreciate, it's the environment, right? It's not just one piece of the puzzle. It's different pieces that come together to build the whole picture. So by having skilled workforce to begin with, so we, as a company, when it comes here, to be able to find skilled workforce that speak English, have a university degree, then having the means to help investments take place and materialize through different incentives, whether being tax breaks or they being grants from the government, and then having in place proper set of rules of how an investment needs to be made following the local set of rules and the energy efficiency, along with building within the environment. It's something that we're really pushing forward, because yes, we're a success story. Yes, our GDP has been one of the best in the Eurozone in 22, and looking forward, supposed to be one of the best in the Eurozone. But you need to continue and build on that effort. We need to kind of look forward at the future, and having the proper big companies that want to invest in Greece means that they are looking at the 5 or 10 years down the line. Having invested in big infrastructure for data centers, or having at this point in time all three major places like Microsoft, Google and Amazon Web Services in Greece, making Greece one of the few countries outside of South America that can house all of this, means that we have the means to support big investments like that.
And that was Marinos Giannopoulos from Enterprise Greece speaking to Andrew Tuck. You were The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
. 7:36 here in London. Let's continue with today's newspapers. I'm delighted to say Vincent McAvinney, political journalist and regular Monocle 24 voices in the studio. Hello, Vinny.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Right. Let's start with British politics and the sort of the forensic or hopefully forensic examination of what Boris Johnson did during lockdown, whether he broke the rules or not.
Mm.
The big inquiry is on its way.
Yeah.
And Boris Johnson's defence dossier is going to be published. How reliable an account is this going to be?
Well, Boris Johnson has long been accused of writing fiction in his journalism, so we'll see what it is that he writes. This account was handed in by the Commons Privileges Committee to the Commons Privileges Committee investigating whether he misled Parliament, which is a serious offence in the UK, yesterday. It was meant to be published, but apparently there have had to be redactions made to protect the identities of some people that Boris Johnson mentioned, and it's expected to be released later today. He'll then be questioned by the seven strong committee of MPs, which is majority conservative, but is chaired by Labour's Harriet Harman, who is the mother of the House. She's the longest serving female MP, so a very experienced politician. So he's going to be questioned by them tomorrow over this, and he'll have to put in quite a performance, because I think it's going to be a very tough the sort of scrutiny that Boris Johnson always manages to avoid often in his public life, a really sort of meticulous poring over his words and whether or not there was truth or not in them. And then next month, after local elections, which are meant to be a sort of quite a big bloodbath for the Conservatives, they will report back and they'll suggest what the punishment should be. And it could be to the point where there is a penalty, which is a docking of his salary, or there is possibly a suspension from the Commons for a specific period. And if it is longer than 10 days, that means that there's the option for his constituents to do what's called a recall. And if enough people vote for a recall, then he could face a by-election.
It would be quite efficient for that to happen for the Conservatives, insofar as Boris Johnson's departure last year, I think people thought it was going to be quite temporary, but the way that the world is moving on without Boris Johnson suggests that actually the Conservatives probably would not would be might be doing themselves a favour to sort of cut off Boris Johnson's, you know, the arm associated with the former Prime Minister.
It potentially is. And what's going to happen? So say if they did say a 10-day suspension, it would then go to MPs to vote on that. And in Boris Johnson, one of the things that brought him down was that when this happened to one of his MPs, Owen Paterson, over breaking rules on lobbying, it's normally a free vote parties give to their MPs on whether or not so-and-so should face a punishment like this. Boris Johnson tried to whip that vote, forcing his MPs to defend and save Owen Paterson, which then backfired on him and they had to U-turn on that. And so Rishi Sunak has made clear this will be a free vote for MPs, and it will show us, you know, Boris Johnson still has a lot of loyal fans on the Tory backbenches, some of whom are already starting to run the flanks, trying to sort of criticise and demean the Privileges Committee. We saw that with Conor Burns, a key ally of Boris Johnson over the weekend, wondering if they could really be impartial. But I think if it is put to a free vote, obviously all of Labour will vote for it, all the other opposition parties will vote for it. It's whether or not there would then be enough MPs willing to say, yeah, we're done with Boris Johnson, that's not the future, we need to stop his comeback in his mind in its tracks. Because I think if he did face that censure and then potentially the by-election, it would stop him the attempts that he's supposedly trying to make to even replace Rishi Sunak before the next general election next year.
Let's move on to the huge story of Xi Jinping's visit to Moscow. In the last few hours, the United States has called on the Chinese president to try to persuade Vladimir Putin to withdraw troops from Ukraine, to stop this invasion. Unlikely, one might suggest. Mm. But it is a very big moment, isn't it, where two of the world's most powerful men sit together and we try to work out what the two of them are going to decide upon.
Two of the world's most powerful men, but also they're in different lifts. One is going up and one is going down. And the one that's going down in global power is the one who's really struggling with this. And the one going up needs to decide whether or not it is worth helping the other out, whether they are going to form this sort of new axis together. You know, Xi Jinping put out a 12-point plan on the anniversary of the war as sort of peace talks. I think that was a sign that he was pretty fed up with what Vladimir Putin had done. It's still not clear if Vladimir Putin had how much he'd shared about the invasion plans. They obviously signed this partnership agreement last year at the Beijing Winter Games, and then a few days later Putin invaded, expecting it to be a couple of days and done. And so China sort of didn't react too heavily at the time. But given all that's gone wrong and the potential now that Russia has for facing this strong spring offensive from Ukraine, resupplied with Western rockets, and still the mass popularity around the world for the Ukrainian cause, or whether Xi Jinping on this trip says to Vladimir Putin, you know, you need to cut this out, you need to get a peace plan in place. Now, the United States have already said that the peace plan that China has put forward isn't acceptable, because it basically would ratify the sort of gains that Russia has made and cut off a part of Ukraine. They've also called it a stalling tactic for Russia as it tries to sort of get room potentially to resupply. There's also the question about whether Xi Jinping will cross a line and start to resupply with weapons. At the moment, they're sort of supplying electronic components and obviously supporting the Russian economy. But it's a very difficult position that Xi Jinping faces. He has just got this historic third term, which he was never supposed to get. But it's whether or not he decides, you know, this is a big moment in history, if he's going to, in a couple of years as expected, make a move on Taiwan, whether he just simply doubles down now, decides that he's going to throw his lot in with Russia, back Putin, and this sort of little kind of satellite alliance that they've got going on of some nations in the sort of global south, some nations in the Middle East, just sort of, you know, tacitly sort of welcoming this sort of counterbalance ran by these two men.
Let's move on to what happens when you move into a new home and you decide to build an extension. it's been done before. We've all thought about, you know, mm-hmm. that extra little bit of space that we'd quite like. Mm-hmm. If you're the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, however, you can't do that without people kicking back.
No, you can't. And this is all to do with an 800 million euro extension to the German chancellery complex, which is already thought to be one of the biggest government headquarters in the world. It's right next to the Bundestag. I've seen it. It's described by locals as the elephant's washing machine. It's all sort of steel, concrete and glass, and as a symbol of sort of reunified Germany. Now, inside, it has already 64,000 square metres of space. space, but it's apparently too small for the staff, which is about 870 employees. Now, that, to give you a comparison, somewhere you and I have both been a lot, Downing Street, it's 70 times larger than Number 10 Downing Street. Now, I'm not saying Number 10 Downing Street is an absolutely terrible building, and the British Prime Minister's office should have been moved from there a long time ago. It should be a residence, and they should have put the sort of office in another building.
It's good to work above the shop.
I don't know. Well, the reason that they never did it is that apparently foreign leaders always want the black door moment. But you could still have that as a sort of, you know, reception area. But, I mean, if you've ever been inside Downing Street, when you read the reports, particularly as, you know, another story today, the Boris Johnson story, about what was going on inside, you just really, you know, they are all elbow by jowl on top of each other. It's not a good place, no. So, but what's going wrong in Germany is that, you know, this would be an extension with a over the river with a tunnel to it. It would have things like a nursery, a helipad, a gym, a new flat for the Chancellor. So some, you know, not just an office, but some amenities as well. But as with every kind of construction thing going on at the moment, the initial estimate of €485 million has ballooned to €777 million. And by comparison, the present building that the Chancellor occupies only cost €543 million in today's prices. So this would be a, you know, this is a big, big extension and costly. And it's whether or not the German people, you know, given the cost of living crisis across Europe, would be willing to put up with this. The argument, it's always tricky with these though, because you do think, you know, the more efficient the space, likely the better government that you'll get. But having to fork out that much for it at this period, probably not a good idea.
It's a question of optics. Vincent McAvinney, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. Let's cross now to Finland. Our Helsinki correspondent, Petri Bertzoff, is standing by to bring us stories from where he is. A very good morning to you, Petri.
Good morning, and dare I say even happy morning.
Well, this is the thing that we have to talk about. I mean, how happy are the Finns? I mean, you've been voted the happiest bunch on earth again. I mean, you're smiling now. I can hear your smile, which is always delightful. But genuinely, I mean, do you all bounce out of bed and go, whoopee, it's a new day?
Absolutely not. I think this is the common misconception regarding this World's Happiest Country report. I mean, it's not about being happy in the sense of being joyful, but rather the report is about how content people are with their lives. In the study that this report is based on, basically asked respondents in every country to evaluate their life using and I'm reading this, the mental image of a ladder with the best possible life for them as a 10 and the worst possible as a 0. You know, it's based on self-appraisal in a sense. So Finns at least feel that they are very content with their lives.
What makes you so content with your lives? Because you're quite right in making that definition, that distinction between happiness, which many suggest can only ever be a temporary state. But then we're getting really philosophical now. Or is it more of a sort of an acceptance of one's lot, a sort of slightly more stoic approach?
I think it's definitely the latter. I mean, if you look at the top 10, all the Nordic countries, which, by the way, as you know, share a very similar social model, they're all in the top 10. So I think it really has to do with a combination of factors, you know, the generous welfare state, free education, free healthcare, social benefits that, you know, you feel like if you fail in life, there's always somebody to look after you. But then it's also, I think it's the trust in both the political institutions and also in other citizens that I think makes the Finnish society quite unique and definitely contributes to this country being the happiest now in, I think it's the sixth year running.
You've been smiling for six solid years. And that's that interesting thing that you say that, you know, once you get a reputation for being happy, in inverted commas, that is borne out by the way that your politicians govern the country.
Yes, that's correct. And I think it's also been interesting to kind of monitor how, since, you know, this is now the sixth year, how the sort of reception of this news has changed. So, you know, when Finland first place number one, it was mostly met sort of with the reaction of, can this really be true? And Finns were kind of in denial, this cannot really be true. And then I suppose over the years, people sort of got used to it and now actually are embracing the fact. So, you know, it's not number one news story anymore. It's still an important news story with, you know, media talking to happiness researchers and so on. But, you know, it's not the biggest news story as it used to be. So I guess that just shows that we are used to it now.
Don't get too down about it if you're not around next year. Question now about the wider issue of the influence of the Russian invasion of Ukraine on the region. We have seen Finland being courted and you know, appeased by Turkey. The chances of it being admitted to NATO very soon are very high. Sweden, however, being left on the sidelines.
Yes, that's correct. And it's been interesting to follow the Swedish reactions to the news that both Turkey and Hungary have signaled that they will ratify Finland's NATO bid in a matter of days. So we saw yesterday the Finnish president Sauli Niinistö gave an interview to the Swedish state broadcaster SVT, where he sort of appealed to the calm of the Swedish population, saying that, you know, it's not actually such a bad deal for Sweden that it's now surrounded by NATO countries on all flanks, given the fact that Sweden actually wants to join the alliance. So that it you know, the fact that Sweden will join NATO later is you know, the fact that all the other countries are already in the NATO, it contributes also to Sweden's security in the meantime before Sweden joins.
And let's move on to a story coming out of Norway and its control of the Arctic. Tell us more about that, Petri.
Yeah, so this is an interesting sort of dispute that has been running a long time. So the Svalbard archipelago, very high in the high Arctic, close to the North Pole, actually, is a point of contention. It's very strategically important group of islands that, in a 1920 legal treaty called the Spitsbergen Treaty, was given to Norway, but other countries were given rights to sort of use the islands for their benefit as well. And now, I believe it was a Latvian fishing company that took the case to the Norwegian Supreme Court, where, because they wanted to fish for snow crab in and around the islands, and the Norwegian High Court then voted that no, you know, it is actually the case that Norway has exclusive rights to the natural resources of this archipelago.
Petri Bertsov in Helsinki, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You are the Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Finally now, let's enjoy a quick and a brilliant roundup of the design news. And I'm delighted to say Nick Moniz, Monocle's design editor, joins me now. Very good morning to you, Nick.
Good morning, Anna Nelson.
What would you like to talk about?
Oh, so many things. I'm actually going to start with one that you sent me. I mean, I don't. Are you coming for my job? Should I be concerned? Or
no, we're all interested in this, in the same joyful approach to life. Especially, we need a nice quality of life. Especially, I think the article was about the vice president's house in the United States.
Kamala Harris and Doug Emhoff have renovated their home on the official grounds of the U.S. Naval Observatory, which you know, is very exciting for them. Obviously, it's but it's also significant, I guess. for the people of the United States in a way that, you know, this is a place, this is a home that is used to hold official receptions, you know, welcome foreign dignitaries. So it does play a role in the state's life. I guess what we're probably more interested in, maybe as anyone that sort of wants to snoop around somebody's recently renovated home, is what they've actually done. So I'm sure you saw some images, but we'll run our listeners through it. Essentially, they tapped a Harlem-based designer, Sheila Bridges, to rework the interiors. So, you know, this is a grand, grand home. It doesn't have a really symmetrical layout. It's kind of a bit odd feeling, from built in 1893. And what Bridges has done is, I guess, tried to reflect some of Harris and Imhoff's personal history and style into the home. So she's kind of tried to bring in a California kind of feel with a color palette that's quite pared back and some bright pops of color. I mean, there's a pink library, which I'm not too sure about.
What's wrong with a pink library?
Nothing wrong with it. I think sometimes these sorts of buildings can you know, or these sorts, I guess, any renovation can carry a mark of their time. So, when the Bushes lived there, for instance, they turned the home's interior into this kind of, I don't want to say gross, that feels mean, but like, well, it was. They used a lot of like lime greens and light blues that did feel very of the time as well. But I think the thing here is that, maybe my only hesitation with the pink library is, again, this is a resident, an official residence, where again, you're entertaining dignitaries. So you want something that is reflective of, I guess, your ethos and your values. And maybe that's a little bit too playful for somewhere where quite serious conversations are going to be taking place.
That's the whole point, isn't it? That people are coming in and stamping their own personal and, you know, dare I say it, they want to make a statement because, you know, this might not be their home forever. And, someone else might be picking up a bit of the bill as well. But when you got Nelson Rockefeller brought in that astonishing cage bed by the surrealist artist Max Ernst, it's one of those moments that you just see how actually tapped in these political figures are into design culture.
Yeah, and I mean, Harris herself, they've tapped Sheila Bridges, as I said, and she is a brilliant designer. It's not just somebody they've plucked out of nowhere. She's worked on, you know, all sorts of, I guess, civic and private homes and residences of famous musicians through to, I think she also did Bill Clinton's own office in Harlem. They worked on all sorts of projects. So they've not just gone and, I guess, found a local contractor, but they've actually searched out somebody with real quality and substance.
Oh, now that would be brilliant. Did you imagine that can you imagine you're told you can only use local hire and you can only use local design? That would be brilliant.
I think if you're going to look at it from a values perspective, I think that's a really nice way to go about it. But whether you'd get probably the outcome that an official residence deserves, I'm not 100% sure of that.
Such a diplomatic answer, Nick.
Well, appropriate for the story, isn't it, Emma? But we can, I guess, move on to the next story. I also flagged in North America, which I do really, really like. It's the opening of the ninth iteration of the Winter Stations Design Festival in Toronto. It sees, I'm not sure if you've been to Canada at this time of year, but I've spent a fair bit of time there and it isn't the most pleasant place to be. I certainly don't want to be outside in Toronto in February and March, where temperatures are freezing, but that doesn't mean that the city doesn't want people to do that. So what City of Toronto does is commission a bunch of outdoor structures and sculptures to be installed on beaches in on its lakefront to bring people out of their hibernation, but also equally, I guess, present an opportunity for young and emerging designers to have their work shown in a very public space and build a folly. You know, architectural projects often take so long to complete. This is something that's going to be done in a matter of months and erected in only a few days. So it's not only a great opportunity to, I guess, bring people out of their homes, but also, I guess, bring young and emerging designers to the forefront.
Nick, thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist. And that's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to all my guests and to our producers, Christy O'Grady, Marcus Hippie and Emma Searle, and our researchers, Lillian Fawcett and Andre Nikolai Parmentuin. Our studio manager was Adam Heaton. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.